Lecture 16, Book 8, The Perfectly Just City Fails.
I begin this lecture precisely where we left at the end of the previous lecture, with the very last proposal that Socrates makes in his enormous construction project of what he claims is a perfectly just city. And this proposal is that everyone over the age of 10 be sent out of the city and into the country so that a clean slate can be established and a new regime can be constructed. Socrates offers this proposal much like he offered the proposal early in the Republic that the family be abolished, that men and women and children all be communally connected through the city. When he said those things in Book 4, he said them with a kind of casualness, as if he were making a minor change in public policy, whereas, in fact, he was making an extraordinarily radical proposal. Glaucon, Adeimantus, catch him on this at the beginning of Book 5. This last proposal I just mentioned is uttered in the same tone of voice, as if it's a change in parking regulations. But, in fact, as only a few seconds of reflection will convince you, it's a monstrous proposal. It's a monstrous proposal, but it contains within it its own kind of logic. The Republic is supposed to be a revolutionary regime. It's going to come into being through a process, first and foremost, of education. It's very difficult to teach an old dog new tricks. And that's why Socrates recommends that everybody over the age of 10 simply be exiled from the city. Now, as I suggested at the end of the previous lecture, this is a euphemism. Socrates actually has in mind something much more drastic, because being sent to the country must be the same as killing them. Otherwise, unless these rulers are so silly that they can't predict this, the people who are sent into the country will get some weapons and come right back into the city to try to get their children back. It might be useful to make a comparison here. I'm thinking of the vicious dictator of Cambodia, who ruled from 1976 to 1979. His name was Pol Pot, and he was a tyrant and a murderer of the highest order. It's estimated that he killed somewhere between 1 and 3 million Cambodians. Now, I mention him because he seemed to have thought of himself as a revolutionary. He called himself Brother Number One. And again, I mention that phrase because it seems to echo with themes that we have extracted from Plato's Republic. You recall the noble lie. The noble lie suggests that all citizens are brothers. The rulers would be first among equals. They would be Brother Number One. Pol Pot, in trying to wipe the slate clean so that a new world could be created, often put children into the vanguard of the revolutionary elite. It's a horrifying story, but it's also instructive. It teaches us something about the nature of revolutionary zeal. When people like Pol Pot, perhaps people like Stalin, are so convinced that they know the absolute truth, that they understand how to move their country ahead, they might very well stop at nothing in order to bring their vision into reality. And the most important thing they must do is transform the population. This goes to the very essence of a revolution. If a revolution is going to succeed, the citizens must be fundamentally altered. They can have within them no vestiges of the old regime. Think also of the Cultural Revolution in China. The campaign was to re-educate all those citizens who still had within them some of the old ways. The new world was being born, and once again, the best representatives of the new world are children. What I'm proposing, in short, is that Socrates' monstrous suggestion at 541a actually makes a very cold, cruel, but logical sense if we think about the nature of genuine revolution. I think we're faced with a dilemma in our reading of the Republic. There are two possibilities. If Socrates and if Plato, who is writing the dialogue, are serious about this last proposal to exile everyone over the age of 10, then we must put them in the same category as Pol Pot and Stalin. They're monsters. If Plato means this seriously, then Plato, in my view, and I hope in your view as well, should be despised. I would argue, however, that Plato is not a monster. And right now, I must warn you that I am going to offer you my own interpretation of this section of the Republic, and indeed of the Republic as a whole. It's very important that you accept what I'm about to say in that spirit. There are many, many scholars who would disagree with me. Some of them are represented in your bibliography. So I'm offering you the best shot I can give, but you yourself should challenge me, because I want to make what in fact is a rather radical suggestion of my own at this stage of our course. I don't think that Plato intends this proposal at 541a in a serious manner. Indeed, I take it to be exactly the opposite. I think that the construction project that Socrates has engaged in from books 2 until the end of the book 7 that we are now studying is what philosophers sometimes call a reductio ad absurdum, a reduction to absurdity. This is often the way that arguments are made. If I can demonstrate that a certain position leads to absurd consequences, then I have argued against the position. In an important sense, I think the so-called just city that Socrates constructs is absurd. I think Plato fully intends it to be absurd. He wants us initially, by us I mean the readers, he wants us initially to be chilled, to be disturbed by it. All along we've wondered, is Plato constructing a totalitarian regime in which sexual reproduction is rigorously regulated, in which people have no freedom, in which poetry is censored, in which the education of the guardians is authoritarianly determined? I would suggest to you, and I reiterate that this is only a suggestion, that this is all part of Plato's strategy. In other words, my interpretation of the Republic leads me to think that this dialogue is, in fact, a critique of political extremism. Plato understands, if I may speak anachronistically, people like Pol Pot. He understands what can happen when revolutionary zeal attempts to put itself into practice. What can happen? Precisely what Socrates proposes at 541a, everyone over the age of 10 is exterminated, so that there can be a clean slate and a brave new world can be constructed. Take that with a grain of salt. Let me move to another angle on this same issue. The issue is the perfectly just city that Socrates proposes possible? This one is going to require far less interpretation on my part, because as you'll see, it's on the surface of the text. Socrates explicitly says what I'm about to describe. Ever since the noble lie, which we encountered in Book 3, Socrates has stressed the importance of what we have been calling eugenics, the control of sexual reproduction, the attempt to create an excellent population. You recall from the noble lie that Socrates says the rulers must first and foremost keep control over the gold-souled people. Gold-souled men must mate with gold-souled women. If by chance they give birth to a silver or bronze-souled child, that child has to be taken away and put into its proper category. Bronze-souled parents will raise bronze-souled children. It's a very horrifying vision that smacks of the sorts of 20th century dystopic novels that we have discussed before, Orwell's 1984, Huxley's Brave New World. What happens at the beginning of Book 8 is extremely instructive in this regard, and I believe it supports my contention that finally Plato is criticizing much of what Socrates has constructed. At lines 546b to 547a, we find an extremely obscure passage. Socrates goes to great length to describe what he calls the marriage number. I won't attempt to decipher the mathematics. If you read it, I can promise you, you'll be puzzled by it because it's very hard to make any sense of it. But this much we know. The marriage number, whatever it actually is mathematically, is an attempt to use mathematical science in the service of eugenics. Plato was a genius at predicting future intellectual developments. He understood, even though he didn't have the science available to him, that something like genetics, a science we now know so well, can be mathematically understood. So the rulers of the so-called just city attempt to create a mathematical science of eugenics. This is the marriage number. And it fails. They fail. And as a result of the failure, there is a chaotic mixing of bronze, silver, and gold-souled people. In short, mathematics cannot control eros. That all-important word in Plato's vocabulary, its basic meaning is sexual desire. It has much broader meanings as well. Again, I would argue that this explicit failure of the marriage number lends support to my general interpretation that, in fact, Plato's Republic, far from being a blueprint that future leaders should follow, is actually a critique of political extremism, a critique of revolutionary zeal. Let me summarize some of the implications of this failure of the marriage number. I think it's instructive because it brings into sharp focus an intersection of two of the main themes that we've discussed since the beginning of this course. The first theme is mathematics, very much the focus of earlier lectures when we were discussing the education of the guardians and the divided line. The second theme is eros. And we have had eros in our view from the opening of the Republic. You recall, I hope, that scene in which the old man Cephalus says, "I don't mind being old, because my sexual desire has quieted. I am no longer tyrannized by Eros. I'm peaceful." That's a peculiar scene if you read it simply in isolation from the rest of the Republic. Now that you've studied a good bit of the Republic, go back to that scene and it will richly echo with later developments in the dialogue. What we're learning in the marriage number failure scene, the beginning of Book 8, is that Plato has been teaching us for all these books about this intersection of mathematics and eros. I would argue, in fact, that these are two of, if not the most important, certainly among the most important themes in the entire dialogue. And to put the point as simply as I can, Plato believes that eros really constitutes the human soul. We are what we love. If we love food, we are food lovers. If we love political power, we're politicians. If we love beauty, perhaps we become artists. If we love wisdom, we're philosophers. To be human is to have strong desires to love. And that is definitive of who we are. This is a theme that is present in many of Plato's dialogues. You might take a look at the Symposium, the Phaedrus, the Lysis. All of these dialogues concern explicitly the subject of eros. Most important, philosophy itself is an erotic activity. Eros has been present from start to finish of the Republic in the person of Glaucon. We are told explicitly that he is an erotic man. It turns out that he seems to be bisexual. He has sexual desires for boys, sexual desires for girls. He's a thoroughly erotic man. It's precisely that fact that makes him into a potential philosopher. Cephalus, a man with no strong desires, can't be a philosopher. Glaucon may well become a philosopher. He may not. The Republic may be yet another instance of Socratic failure. I mentioned this in the previous lecture. But he may. He has the potential energy to pursue the extraordinarily difficult tasks that philosophy demands of us. We have seen exactly what these tasks are. Let me return you to the divided line. And if you recall, I suggested to you at the time that the crucial move in the divided line is to turn around, to resist the temptation of intellectual gravity. That's the moment when, having achieved some knowledge of mathematics, we go back to the sensible world where mathematics proves to be so useful. Instead, the true philosopher must resist that temptation, turn around, and move upwards. This requires energy. This requires passion. Glaucon has that. Let me turn to mathematics. I've spent much of the previous couple of lectures explaining how important, how valuable, how good mathematics is to Plato. You'll recall that the study of mathematics, geometry in particular, was a prerequisite for getting into Plato's academy, and I am not retracting any of those sentiments. Mathematics is good, according to Plato, but it's not the best. Mathematics is in between. It's a very important subject to study, which is why it represents the bulk of the guardian's education in Book 7. However, it's not the ultimate form of intellectual inquiry. It can't capture what is essential to being human. In order to understand the human soul, some form of intellectual inquiry that's other than mathematics, and in fact is greater than mathematics, is required. And that's dialectic, that's philosophy as Socrates practices it. So, to summarize one more time, Socrates has views which are very similar to our own. For us and for Socrates, good science, good useful technical knowledge is mathematical. At the time he was writing, Plato was unaware of the extraordinary developments that, of course, we live with today, but the basic idea was already present even in ancient Athens. However, mathematical science can't get the job done completely. It can't capture what is essential to being human, this capacity for eros. As a result, there can be no real philosopher king or philosopher queen. Such a person would be the person who could mathematically engineer the population of the city. And this, we discover explicitly at the beginning of Book 8, is a failure, the failure of the marriage number. With the failure of the marriage number, we have come to the end of the construction project. The Republic is structured very clearly. Book 1 is the prologue, Books 2, 3, 4, Books 5, 6, 7, and then Books 8, 9, 10 are three distinct sections, each of equal length. We have just completed that central section, 5, 6, 7. It's ended in failure. Might be interesting to turn back to the very beginning of that section, the very beginning of Book 5. You'll recall that at the end of Book 4, Socrates says to Glaucon and Adeimantus, Plato's brothers, I'm done. I've created a just city. Now it's my chance to tell you about unjust cities. At that point, he is arrested. Of course, that was a playful, metaphoric use of the notion of being arrested. But the young men around him say, wait a minute, Socrates, you can't do this. You can't go on to the next stage of the conversation. You have to explain to us this bizarre proposal you made that women and children and men will live in common and there'll be no private sexual relationships. That's an interruption. That's a trigger for what in fact is a digression. And the trigger is eros. So Books 5, 6, and 7, the central, the philosophical books of the Republic, all constitute a very, very long detour, a detour triggered by eros. Now that we have ended that stage, we're ready to resume the project that Socrates mentioned at the end of Book 4, and that is a discussion of the mistaken regimes. And this constitutes the bulk of Books 8, 9, and 10. We are clearly on the descent. We are headed downwards. Using the language of the parable of the cave, we're headed back into the cave. We're headed away from the so-called perfectly just city into the real world. The best regime, the so-called perfectly just city, could also be described as an aristocracy. This English word comes from two Greek words. The first, aristos, means excellent or best. The second comes from the Greek word krate, which means power or rule. The aristocracy is rule by the best, rule by the excellent. In the case of the Republic, the aristocracy is not a matter of family lineage. To be an aristocrat is to be, of course, a philosopher. But as we have just learned at the beginning of Book 8, the aristocracy fails. The failure of the marriage number. And as a result, we move to the second best regime. This regime is called the timocracy. The suffix is the same. It comes from the Greek word krate, power or rule. The prefix is from the Greek word time, which means honor. The timocracy is ruled by those who love honor, those who love victory. Socrates then launches into a description of the timocratic regime as well as the timocratic individual. And this is a pattern that will be consistent for books 8 and 9. Books 8 and 9 you might think of as having four chapters. There are four mistaken regimes. These four regimes will be the timocracy, the oligarchy, the democracy, and finally, worst of all, the tyranny. And there will be four corresponding personality types or character types. And of course, these will be the timocrat, the oligarch, the democratic human being, and the tyrant. And in each case, you'll find Socrates telling stories about how the individuals in this regime came about, how they emerged from the previous regime, and what they're like. Correspondingly, we learn, of course, what the regime is like in which they are dominant. So let's begin this process by taking a very quick look at the genesis of the timocratic man. This is found 549c to 550b. This is the person who has a father who was an aristocrat, a member of that so-called perfectly just city. The father, because he was an aristocrat, was not concerned with money or power. We've witnessed Socrates criticize those potential good things and instead replace them by the love of real wisdom and real excellence. But the mother of this timocratic man is angry at her husband because he doesn't have sufficient money or power. He spent all his time in the quest for this idealistic excellence and as a result is impoverished and without real political power. The mother, says Socrates, is bitter and she puts pressure on her son. What happens to the child? Common sense will tell you, and I'm referring now to lines 550A. The son is conflicted. He's drawn in two directions. The father is advocating the pursuit of excellence. The mother is advocating the pursuit of money and power. What does the son do? He chooses a middle path. He becomes a lover of victory and honor. This is midway between the mother's desire, which is simply for money and power, and the father's idealistic desire for genuine excellence. The timocratic ruler and the timocratic regime are pretty good because the love of honor, Socrates says, is a very useful regulating and disciplining principle. If a ruler loves honor, they're not going to live in grand palaces. They're not going to exploit their citizens. They're not going to boast about their wealth. They're concerned with the honors that the citizens themselves will confer upon them. However, to repeat what will be the basic pattern of this entire section of the Republic, the timocratic ruler, as we've discussed, is conflicted. Socrates has a wonderful description of this person. At 548a, he says, under the cover of darkness, he pays fierce honor to gold. The mother, you recall, is pressuring this boy to do better than the impoverished father and to make a lot of money. But the father is putting such pressure on the boy to care about excellence. So the boy comes up with a compromise. In public, he is regulated by the love of honor, but as a result of all of his victories, his military victories, his political victories, he actually has amassed quite a fortune. But he won't allow himself to worship this fortune in public, only at night, when the doors are closed, will he gaze at his own wealth and really fall in love with it? The pattern is now set for the rest of books 8 and 9. We will repeatedly see such instances of psychological conflict and political strife.